Get ready for the Ocelli effect.
I'm a big fan of the show.
Chuck Ocelli, and he's been known for many years as a blind JFK researcher specializing in intelligence agency involvement in multiple assassination, propaganda, and other global criminal operations in the 20th and 21st centuries.
Your listeners are extremely fortunate to have you, and everybody at AFR I know loves you, man.
We should learn from our relatively recent history, my brother. That's where I'm coming from. I say all power to the people.
And now, the most underrated voice in all media. The alternative, Chuck Ocelli.
28 September 2016, that is the date, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is the Ocelli Effect, broadcast live from the Network of Origin, American Freedom Radio at AmericanFreedomRadio.com. We do welcome you no matter how it is you came to the show this evening. We are quite happy to have you along. No matter how you encountered it, whether you've utilized your Fondle Slab of choice and decided to pick it up as a podcast later, go to the AFR archives, pick it up on YouTube, the iTunes store, whatever it may be, you are equally welcome. So, I am not going to belabor the points of last night and go through the debate anymore or any of that other nonsense because, you know what, a lot of this stuff really is just circus without the bread. I have really, really gotten into a very deep sort of mindset regarding the apparent agenda of continuous warfare. We've discussed it several times on this show. We've absolutely gone over what I consider to be a lot of criminal operations which have been conducted by those who choose to be war profiteers. One of those subjects which I have absolutely hammered to death on this show is the invasion / occupation of Iraq. We've covered it in great detail with Frank Gregory Ford. We've covered it in great detail with others who were there. We've covered it in great detail with those who seem to have a level of expertise and might be able to look at it from the outside, people that are much more familiar with the military than I could ever be. Because, quite honestly, as you all well know, I was incapable of serving, although I may have served if I could have. It really is irrelevant at this point. I'm a civilian. I get that. But understanding it from the outside and trying to look at what's going on, what is the thing that really disturbs me the most? Not just the fact that there are people that profit off of war, not just for the fact that there are vampires apparently across the planet who benefit on nothing but the misery of others and the bloodshed which can be produced by many industries. No, not just that, but the fact is that there are good people that don uniforms, that are serving you, me, everyone in a capacity, okay, that in some cases is absolutely horrendous, that is absolutely torturous to endure. They volunteer for that in this day and age. And at all times, I give great consideration to those individuals who have sacrificed in that way. Does it sound counterintuitive considering the fact that I really would like to see a planet where warfare and weapons are not necessary, where militaries are obsolete because we no longer have any sorts of conflicts or struggles over land, resources, any of that? Well, no, it's not counterintuitive. I know the world I live in, and I know the necessity by which the military must operate. However, as an American citizen, as a person living in this country, as all of you should be, we should at all times be vigilant about the way that those people who volunteer to serve are being treated. One of the people that I brought up on this show many, many times, and I have called her General Janice Karpinski, despite the fact that she was demoted at one point, as far as I'm concerned, there was no just cause for doing so. And I've talked about that on this show many times. Of course, she comes up often in conversation with Frank Gregory Ford. She comes up in conversation every time we discuss Iraq and the very, very ugly situation of Abu Ghraib and the fact that there was a whole lot more going on over there under the auspices of the war on terror. And there is still today, to this day, I guarantee you, things going on that are ugly, really deplorable, against international law, and all of that which every single one of us should be jumping up and down and screaming about, because these things are all being done in our name. But Janis Karpinski, it's amazing. You know, you're with me tonight, and it is a real honor to have you on. I want, finally, for you to be able to speak for yourself, because you've been referenced so many times on here. You have been discussed on this show. What happened at Abu Ghraib has been discussed on this show. You know, and in the private little enclave, let's call it, that I have with the listeners before I go on air, and some of the people that interact with me who listen to the show regularly, you know, a little joke started to pop up. We started calling you Wonder Woman. And it's no disrespect intended, absolutely not. Why? Because, you know what, there was a point in time when I felt as though, and here I go with my ignorant younger days, I felt as though women should not even serve in the military in combat situations. I really felt that way because I did not have a complete understanding of what it would be like to see someone who was not being given promotions for the sake of, you know, affirmative action, let's call it. I did not know what it would be like to see someone who was not essentially almost like a vanity piece being shown to the American public for the purposes of promoting the idea that, you know, that really women soldiers were as valuable as they are. I have since revised that position. I got to be honest with you, a study of your career should revise anybody's position regarding this, because quite honestly, and I didn't even say this to you off the air, but I will say it right here and now in public, the fact is you have more guts and have been more consistent and more honorable than most of the males who I have had the opportunity to deal with, who were in positions of command, et cetera, et cetera. And the fact is, you know, the idea that you were publicly defamed is so disgusting to me, not just because you were a woman, but because you were an honorable person serving in the military. And what happened to you is entirely just so reprehensible, I don't really have words to explain it. But before we get to all that, here's what I'd like to do, though, is give people, because we could go to your Wikipedia page right now, okay? And trust me, I will shut up shortly. I want to let Janis speak, but I wanted to make sure I got all this out, because we're going to get very in-depth about these topics. We're going to hear from Janis herself, you know, in a firsthand fashion, what it is that I have been referencing, what it is that has been referenced here regarding the situation. And it's really a unique honor and privilege to have you on tonight. But just to take a look at, you know, the bullet points, let's just say, of your career is really not an accurate snapshot. But let's understand something. You received at one point the Bronze Star. You received Meritorious Service Medals, I believe, three times. Army Commendation Medals three times, Army Achievement Medals, probably other awards as well. But you served in combat, if I understand correctly, seemingly in Iraq, to your credit, as far as I know, the Gulf War, what they might call Desert Storm, things like that is one of the things that you served in directly, and also the more recent invasion/occupation of Iraq. This is primarily where you were engaged in military operations in a very direct sense. But you have a long career here. You have an education as well, including a Master of Arts in Strategic Study from the U.S. Army War College. Okay, as well as other education. It's not as though this was your only level of education. You have other degrees as well. But not only are you a soldier, but an intelligent soldier and somebody who deserved to be promoted to the rank of general. And to the best of my knowledge, the only one that I've ever seen that has had a star removed from them in this fashion. But if you would be so kind as to sort of summarize your military career for people just as a point of reference, I would really appreciate it.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. I'm really excited about the discussion. I'm happy to provide as much information as I can. I will tell you that it's all firsthand information. So I will tell you very briefly about my career. When I went into the military, they were starting to open doors for women. And the real motivation for it was there when the draft was over, Vietnam was over, they were cutting people in certain specialties, like pilots were being released from the military because there were too many in numbers to fight a war. They needed them, and after the war, they didn't. So there weren't people signing up or staying in. Like I said, Vietnam was over. People were fleeing the military service after the draft. So they were opening doors from a practical perspective. They wanted to get ahead of the civilian world in some respects because they knew that under pressure there would be more and more women going into the workplace and expecting equal treatment and promotions, et cetera. So the military got on board and opened up specialties previously closed to women, military police being one of them, military intelligence being one of them. They were allowed for years to serve in clerical positions, hospital positions, nursing positions. So they opened up more opportunities for women. It wasn't necessarily met with lots of cheers and finally celebrations, because the men that had pretty much dominated the military since its creation were not too happy about bringing women into units that were previously closed to women. So they forgot to retrain those individuals who were still making the decisions about promotions and assignments, et cetera. So I got into the military, served in the military police, went to jump school, airborne training at Fort Benning, and went to Fort Bragg as my first assignment. So jumping right into the fire. But I really believed from the beginning, if I'm going to do this, I want to be in the most exciting assignments available to me. So I was not disappointed. I served with 7th Special Forces Group at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. We had a 24-hour notification for deployment around the world. Deployed many times, spent a lot of time in the field, was a platoon leader with a military police unit, left there, went to the advanced course, finished the advanced course, went to Germany, had leadership positions in Germany, worked special service investigations, because at that time we were dealing with the Red Brigade and the beginning of terrorism in Europe. And a lot of Air Force bases were being targeted.
Right.
I spent my time there, came back to the United States, served in command assignments at Fort McPherson, Georgia, had the Honor Guard under my command. It was military police units. And transitioned at that point out of the active duty and went into the reserve component. Served in demanding leadership assignments throughout my time in the reserve component. And there is a distinct difference between people who serve in the reserve and National Guard. These are our citizen soldiers, okay? They bring a wealth of knowledge from their civilian jobs and positions to the military free of charge. They serve in a variety of positions, maybe from experience that they had on active duty, maybe not. But I looked for and was accepted into any variety of leadership positions in the reserve components, and spent a great deal of time driving to and from assignments, flying to and from assignments, where other people said, that's not what I'm about, give me a staff job, let me get my 20 years and retire. And that's perfectly acceptable because they bring civilian skills, as I said, to the table.
Right. Now, if you don't mind, I'd like to interrupt you and ask a question here, because this is a remarkable time for various reasons. The beginning of your military career is literally after the Vietnam conflict ends, if I understand correctly. I think you started in 1977, okay,
correct.
Which means that Vietnam was just freshly finished, so to speak. And we see a transition here post-Vietnam era in the military where the reserves were really transitioned into a much more active component, it seems, in a military sense. Now, it could be because I'm an outsider that I don't necessarily understand this, but wasn't this a transition, really, for the way that business had been conducted regarding the reservists in the military?
Absolutely. If you can recall, and it carried on for some several years after Vietnam was over, but Reserve and National Guard soldiers were a lot of people joined, a lot of men joined the reserves or the National Guard in advance of being drafted for active duty. But they were bringing Reserve and National Guard components into the war in Vietnam and serving that purpose as it's configured to do. But on drill weekends, if you will, once a month they would go for a weekend drill, they'd wear wigs because they didn't want to cut their hair off. And it was a big controversy, but there wasn't anything in the regulations that said they couldn't wear a short-haired wig to be in compliance with the regulations. So there was a disconnect, that's putting it mildly, between the Reserve and National Guard forces and the active duty, because the active duty felt like a lot of Reserve and National Guard soldiers were simply signing up for those assignments, so they did not have to be deployed to Vietnam. But when the war was over, Reserve and National Guard units were filling up because the soldiers who were drafted needed to fulfill the rest of their obligation in Reserve and National Guard unless they were discharged for any variety of reasons. So the Reserve and the National Guard pretty much stayed, I'd say, status quo. The next time that they really made the headlines was in Desert Storm.
Right.
And what happened in Desert Storm kind of shook the whole system, if you will, at least in the Army. And I can safely say it sent tremors to the Air Force as well. The Marine components have always used their reserve components as if they were active duty. There were no exceptions to standards. They had to do a physical training test. They had to be ready as they walked in the door of a drill weekend. They saw no distinction except active component were there 24/7, and the Reserve and National Guard, the Marine Corps, was there on their drill weekends, but expected to keep current in the days between drills. When they mobilized the Army Reserve components and National Guard, but primarily Reserve components during Desert Storm, and deployed them, it was clear from the beginning that these units were well prepared, well trained, ready to fight. And they did an exceptional job. And here's what happened. When that very short war was over and these soldiers returned to their units, when promotion boards met, the fact that they had the combat patch on the right shoulder spelled the difference between their promotions and advanced schooling and active duty unit members who needed those same schools and those same promotions, who did not deploy, who did not have combat service in their record. And it was a huge difference, and it had a huge impact on decisions that were made during the Iraq War. Okay? So you have soldiers in the reserve components and the National Guard who now have combat experience and have returned to the reserve components and the National Guard, and they are, in fact, more qualified in terms of service in combat than their active component counterparts.
Which was interesting to me because, quite honestly, I was born in 1972, okay? So my friends that were one way or another going into military service at exactly the time that Desert Storm happened. Okay, this is when I watched this really from a firsthand kind of perspective, right? I mean, I'd been alive at the tail end of Vietnam, but I was a small child. Mm-hmm, this to me was the first deployment of young men that I knew. This was the first time this would happen. And it was interesting to me because it seemed as though there was a grand sort of shakeup where reservists and in fact National Guard people were not really there, you know, the idea that they were sort of avoiding really being real soldiers and this kind of attitude was at that time being changed. Now, somebody might say to themselves, well, why is this relevant to the discussion? Well, because by the time we get into the next conflict in Iraq, it's a whole new story, really, compared to any of the conflicts that we had seen before. Yes, Desert Storm was very short-lived, so therefore there wasn't a need for all of these rotations that have happened, people being redeployed repeatedly. Stuff like that. But when we go into Afghanistan and Iraq, we now have a different landscape regarding this, don't we?
Absolutely. And remember, if you are going to get unit leaders, commanders, general officers, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, if the Secretary of Defense wants their support on any plans of a deployment in Iraq to eliminate Saddam or whatever the storyline was, you choose words amongst them in briefings. You choose words carefully and coach them into believing this is going to be another short war. They're going to be there for less than 90 days. And remember, again, I have to reference this. Remember what happened in Desert Storm. All those reservists and National Guard soldiers, they all got combat patches. They all got combat experience, and they were home in less than 30 days. So get your units fired up. Tell them the benefits of this deployment. We want a lot of hit, click, hooray. We want a lot of support for this. They're going to be home before they know they were done. Okay.
Right.
And they sent general officers throughout the reserve components to deploying units, mobilizing and deploying units. And at the time it was General Blum and the National Guard, but he made sure that each one of his units that was being mobilized to deploy, that they were briefed, that they were, and it wasn't these exact words, but let me tell you, and this is important to understand how the war started in terms of mentally in soldiers' heads. That's why I'm going to mention this. General Blum made sure that every one of the units was briefed. The Army Reserve component sent general officers out. Maybe some of them never had combat experience. They went and did the hooah-hooah talk to the units, said, okay, look, you're going to be given a set of orders. It's for a period of 90 days. When you're back in 30 days, you'll be given another set of orders that cancels those orders. So don't think you're going to draw pay for 90 days when you're back in 30 days. Okay? Never talked about beyond 90 days. Never talked about possibility of extending. Because they were briefing the information they had received from their commanders. So they go to these units. The family members are all there. Tears, fear. These are not combat soldiers. These are military police units and signal units and support units and truck drivers and all of the support that comes from the reserve component. And they're all believing that they're going to get 170 orders for 179 days or 90 days, but they're coming back in 30 days, no problem. And it is a big problem because they get there and then they can't get out. They extend them. It's like a blanket extension, 6 months for everybody that's here. And then it became, as everybody knows, 365 days boots on the ground. So in the world of the active component, you know your stuff is straight in the finance office and in the medical services. Your family's going to be taken care of, whether they're in housing on base or in an apartment. Their paycheck is going to come, and they're going to be taken care of. Not so in the reserve components or in the National Guard. And it doesn't make any difference which service we're talking about. The finances were screwed up. Their orders expired after 90 days or 179 days, and their pay stopped. Their families didn't have food on the table. Their apartments were asking for the rent. Don't talk about the Soldier and Sailor Protection Act. People want it. Their mortgages had to be paid. Their insurance had to be paid. They were being thrown out of base housing because they didn't have orders that extended them to be there. No medical support. And no effective communication at the time. You couldn't pick up a phone and call back home and say, don't worry, it's under control. The only general officer from the National Guard who came to explain it to his unit was General Blum. The only one. And he said, look, guys, it's on me. I did this. We're going to fix it, but be patient with me. The commander of the Army Reserve, General Helmley at the time, he came, saw one unit that was close to the Baghdad airport, spent 2 hours there, and left. Soldiers were angry, justifiably pissed off, excuse my French, but they were angry because the military abandoned them. And every step of the way, they were stepping up to the plate, they were mobilizing, they were leaving their civilian jobs, they were giving notices to their families and to their bosses and to their companies, and they were taking a cut of, in pay in a lot of cases, and they were deploying. And the Army abandoned them.
Well, so and this is in, yeah, this is extremely important to understand, though, because this explains to me a lot of the behavior that we see, a lot of the fact that, you know, if you mislead your people. Okay, if you mislead your people and they have these other worries, look, if a guy is in the field and he's trying to do his job, but he's worried that his wife and his children are not going to have a place to be or food on the table or whatever else while he is putting his life on the line, I mean, let's be honest. If you were working at McDonald's, you'd be distracted by that. You know, these guys that are out there as engineers or as military police or who are actually in combat or going on these, you know, sweep and collect missions or whatever it is you want to call them, you know, you mean to tell me that this is not going to be an operational problem on the ground? You know, I'm not obviously asking you that. I'm saying that just from a sheerly logical standpoint as an outsider, I'm saying to myself, I don't blame these guys if they were making mistakes or anything else, because this is something they should not have to be worried about while they're doing this job.
Absolutely. So I go to brief all of my units because you could feel the anger from a distance. My predecessor left all of that in my hands and leaves. Can't wait to get out of the UK. He leaves Kuwait the day the change of command ceremony takes place. He doesn't want to give me a briefing. He doesn't want to talk about what it was. Just says, be careful. And off he goes. So I'm going to visit every one of my units, and let me tell you, soldiers were angry, and that justifiably so. So I take their list of complaints almost to a unit. The top one is finance. I go to the finance office, and the guy, the sergeant first class in the finance office, who was an exceptional soldier, said to me, ma'am, I will bend over backwards to try and help, but I don't know anything about the pay system for the reserves or the National Guard. It's not even on our database. But I will work to figure this out because we're not going to let our soldiers down. Not your soldiers, our soldiers.
Right.
Meanwhile, senior leadership is making a big distinction between, oh, well, that's just the reserves. That's just the National Guard. There was a huge disconnect. And, yes, soldiers, there was no funding line for equipment or repair parts or anything else in the reserve in the National Guard. We had to beg, borrow, and steal with cooperation from active duty units just to get the smallest pieces of repair parts. That's why when Secretary Rumsfeld went and he said he saw Humvees without doors on them and put some sandbags in the bottom, that should save your neck. He was there for less than 24 hours and then left. Yeah, he didn't have to worry about his neck being saved because he had about 50 people traveling with him for security. And it was so that lasted for the first 2 years of the war. And remember, all of the brainwashing that they did beforehand, 30 days, you'll be home. 30 days, you'll be home. So I'm a general officer, and I encountered other general officers and colonels, full colonels, who said, oh, ma'am, we're so glad you're here because now you can take over and we can go home. I said, what do you mean, go home? And, yes, we've been here for 32 days already. We're going home, get refreshed, get organized, and then we'll be back. And I said, yeah, well, it's the comeback part that has me concerned. Mm. We don't have equipment lines. We don't have the right defense equipment. We do not have this. We, as a reserve unit, and it's the case for most reserve units and National Guard units, you kind of plug in to an active component unit for repair parts, supply, logistics, funding, that kind of thing. Well, all of the reserve units and National Guard units, when they arrived in Iraq from Kuwait, when we all moved forward at various times, of course, but as we moved forward, all of those docking locations that we should have plugged into, sorry, closed. No vacancies.
Well, you know, and the reason why I want you to go into this in depth as you have here is because I'm trying to set the stage in people's minds for what happens here. And look, the American public here at home, right, we started to hear about how there was not equipment available for people that were in harm's way. We started to hear, you know, little drives to try and purchase what? Kevlar.
Vests, boots, anything that would protect them.
Right.
Yes, absolutely. And the reason it's so important, and it's very critical, because then you have soldiers who are taking matters into their own hands. They, and if you need to fast forward to Abu Ghraib, we can, because it has a tremendous application. My units, I did have logistic units. I did have water and bath units, but the majority of my units were military police units with a variety of assigned missions, combat missions, control on the battlefield, but the majority of them were prisoner of war operations in whatever capacity they would serve, whether that meant going out to the divisional units, picking up the prisoners that they had policed up off the battlefield and bringing them back to the camps, but all in the prisoner of war world. And they were well trained to conduct prisoner of war operations. Prisoner of war camps, prisoner of war, the doctrine is clear. It was crystal clear then. It is from World War II, okay? Status of Forces Agreement, the Geneva Hague Conventions, all of it. They knew what they were doing. They practiced during annual training. They practiced on drill weekends. Were they absolutely perfect? No, because you have to be flexible enough to adjust to the situation. But that's not what we were facing in Iraq. What we were facing the first...
Right.
Go ahead. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say is at this point, I enter another commonly understood thing in the public. And it's, you know, in June 2003, according to what I've been able to dig up, it says the U.S. Led occupation of Iraq. Karpinski was given command of the 800th Military Police Brigade, which meant she was responsible for the 15 detention facilities in southern and central Iraq run by coalition forces.
Right.
It also says you were given command of the National Guard and Army Reserve units in Iraq, in the Iraqi city of Mosul in January 2004. Okay. The next entry here is where things get a little bit ridiculous in my estimation. Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez formally suspended Karpinski and 16 other soldiers with undisclosed reprimands. An investigation was started into the abuse at Abu Ghraib, and Karpinski left Iraq for reasons that were explained at the time as part of, quote, routine troop rotations. Okay. On April 8, 2005, Karpinski was formally relieved of command of the 800th Military Police Brigade. On May 5, 2005, President George W. Bush approved Karpinski's demotion to colonel from the rank of brigadier general. Her demotion was not officially related to the abuse at Abu Ghraib. Now, I'm going to stop there because here is where we get into, because first I want people to recognize that there is a condition which has now been put into place here with a whole lot of individuals who thought they were going to rotate in and rotate out of Iraq. They have been exhausted. They are undersupplied. Although they may have been fully trained, there is a lot of other things that are happening. And I know you're going to provide us with some of that information now as we begin to discuss Abu Ghraib. And Abu Ghraib is the most notable. But there were other things going on there and people starting to take things into their own hands. Well, it wasn't merely just a breakdown of people not reporting the events correctly to their commanders, but there were also military contractors involved. There were also other individuals who you had absolutely no control over that were involved as well. And it becomes a real huge convoluted mess. And I think that quite honestly, this is just my observation, but it seems to me as though the civilian command component here really made this disaster happen. And it's really even worse, I think, than the public understands what really happened here. But to me, it seems as though you were thrown under the bus after your subordinates did not do their jobs correctly. And they did not report to you correctly.
Can I just correct that? Because I have to, in their defense, remember, these are prisoner of war operation units. That means they know the law, they know the Geneva Conventions, they know all of the rules that apply to housing and protecting prisoners of war. So the first, now what happened in Afghanistan with the prisoners, it ultimately led to the actions that were taken against prisoners at Abu Ghraib, because it was the major who was running those operations who then floated to Iraq and met up with Major General Miller, and the rest, as they say, is history. But it's important to understand that there is a distinction between prisoner of war operations and circulation and control military police operations on the battlefield. So you have soldiers. Prisoner of war operations are in the rear in a classic battlefield. They're far removed. Why? Because you are obligated to protect the prisoners while they are prisoners of war under your control. So in a lot of cases, the prisoner of war camps are not even in the same country where the war is taking place. Very close to the Kuwait border was the first, that was Camp Buka, that was the first prisoner of war camp formed in Abu Ghraib, in Iraq, excuse me. The Abu Ghraib started very, very early on after the declaration of war as a prisoner drop-off location. There was no running water there. There was no electricity there except by generators. The unit that was running the operations there was out of Las Vegas, Nevada. They were a great MP unit, and they would process the prisoners and hold them there until they were transported down to Buka, the prisoner of war camp, the only prisoner of war camp in operation in Iraq. Mm-hmm. So when you declare mission accomplished on the battleship by the President of the United States, the declaration is made, mission accomplished. What happens at that? That's a critical point, because what happens then, you begin release operations for prisoners of war, and that, those took place. And it was very orderly. It was by the book. They ended up with less than 80 special category prisoners, if you will. But and some of them were family members. But the prisoners of war were released. According, in conjunction with the American Red Cross, the International Red Cross, sorry, and the procedures followed by the processing unit's knowledge. There was no question about it. It was appropriate. Were there some mistakes made during that time? That was before I got there. But, yeah, there were some mistakes, but it's to be expected. I think the largest number of prisoners of war during the war was really several thousand. Overall, and they were released back to society as it should be after the war. Some of them were from outside of Iraq, whatever. But what happened then, they, instead of allowing the 800 MP brigade units to return home then, because the war was over, prisoner of war operations are over, they just dropped a new mission on the 800th MP brigade. Just dropped it. No discussion, no policy. No, this is the way it's going to work. No discussion whatsoever. You are now jailers. You're going to run the Iraqi detention system. You're going to, as the units police up people that are nonviolent criminals, really. They're in possession of a weapon in their car. It's after they're caught looting. They're caught after curfew, whatever it might be. Iraqi citizens that are then arrested and turned over to an American-run jailhouse. And I use that term very loosely. Because
right.
A lot of those jails were concertina wire, 2x4s, and military police personnel protecting them. But these were not prisoners of war. That changed at the beginning of September 2003, when General Miller came and delivered Secretary Rumsfeld's new instruction. And it changed the climate, it changed the mission, it changed everything. And it allowed...
Not to belabor the point too much, but, you know, you draw a distinction here between people that are being held in a jail, effectively, and prisoners of war. Now, I want to see if I understand this, and maybe we can make this real clear to the listener. There is a different set of standards for how it is one handles a prisoner of war as opposed to just a prisoner. Is that right, or am I misreading this?
No, you're absolutely right. And people mixed the terms together, and that's where the confusion started. Prisoners of war are treated by a set of international standards, the Geneva Hague Conventions. Everybody is familiar with them. Everybody knows them. And they were, in our history, they were applied, and the International Red Cross would come in and check on the conditions in the camps. They would, if prisoners were held long enough, sometimes they would be work parties, but whatever unfolded in regular prisoner of war operations. For running the entire Iraqi criminal detention system, nobody was trained for it. And it has never, yet they've never used an American unit of any kind to run a country's entire prison system before. They brought over four civilian contractors to set a program up for this and to run it. They did not speak a word of Arabic. They did not understand anything in Iraq. They were there on very lucrative contracts. They were sent initially for 90 days, and they were not equipped with magic wands. They were sent there to write the policy and set up and become operational in 90 days, the Iraqi detention system. Didn't happen.
This is where the 15 facilities, though, that they list come into play, because there was really only three, I think, previous to that, right?
That's correct. That's correct. And like I said, Abu Ghraib, before this this visit by these contractors and General Miller, Abu Ghraib was in a dangerous location. It was at the right at the vortex of the most dangerous location in Iraq, just outside of Baghdad. But it was sandy. It was rubble. It had been blown to smithereens when Saddam released all the prisoners in advance of the war. The doors to the jail cells were torn off, literally. It had been heavily looted by the locals for every piece of metal, every piece of copper, every piece of wire that was on site. And it was multiple acres, multiple. It was just a convenient location. And of course, then when they said that they were going to make it into a large prison operation to turn back over to the Iraqis, the Iraqis, as well as the American, there was several agencies like humanitarian services that came in, and they went out to visit Abu Ghraib. None of them, I quote one woman who said, absolutely not, we do not agree with this concept. We do not want to be painted with the same brush. And those contractors briefed Secretary Rumsfeld, and he said, do it. They briefed Ambassador Bremer, he said, do it. They briefed Sanchez, he said, do it. Against all of the arguments that these other organizations were putting on the table, they did it. And they put about, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars into Abu Ghraib to get the cell blocks operational again, to get an operational as an over, I mean, let me tell you. There was rarely electricity out there. And one of the smaller detention facilities, not a interrogation facility, in downtown Baghdad, one of the smaller ones, the MPs, you know, it had been these contractors brought in contractors, local contractors. They put the cell doors back on and everything. And one time the MPs came back after dinner and all of the prisoners were in the courtyard of this facility. And they put the hinge pins on the doors, the contractors did, on the prisoner side. So all the prisoners did was remove the hinge pins and took all the doors off, and they were waiting for the MPs when they came back. They thought it was great fun.
Yeah, well, no, I can see what's happening here, you know, but the fact is that this was really an inadvisable facility. This was an inadvisable situation. This was just poorly done. And meanwhile, you're left to have to deal with this.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just.
And meanwhile, they're sending General Sanchez and General Fast, who was the intelligence officer for General Sanchez. They reassigned the military intelligence unit to Abu Ghraib to come out and interrogate these prisoners, Iraqi prisoners now. They're still the criminal element. They're starting. We have more room out at Abu Ghraib, outside room. The camps are set up with concertina wire and barbed wire, triple strand, and they're outside in the element. But these are local Iraqi criminal elements. Like I said, 99% were nonviolent. We didn't have rapists or murders or anything else that were being held in our prison. And at that time, we, on the military intelligence, not contractors, but on the military intelligence, they would be giving, they would be reviewing the records of these individuals and then making a recommendation to release them or to hold them for further questioning. Maybe they had some other value or whatever. But the vast majority of them were recommended for release.
Wait a second here, because I want to make sure I understand something. Not only are you charged with the responsibility of handling, holding enemy combatants, okay, for lack of a better term, not only are you charged with the constant imprisonment of people that are later to be called insurgents, okay, but also the local criminal element has now fallen under this umbrella. And there is an entire mixture in this prison system of these people that now you're in charge of, and you're being given a really an unmanageable and totally destroyed facility, number one. But number two, a vast array of individuals with no time to set these things up. Plus, there was others being collected by different sweeps, if I understand correctly here, by active units who were picking up people that were suspected of this, suspected of that. In some cases, they didn't even really have a name or anything like that, but they had a general description. So there were literally sweeps happening where, like, say, anybody who was between the age of 20 and 30 that had a beard, this kind of thing, almost that general, was being picked up and also thrown in with, you know, a variety of criminals, one, enemy combatants that were real enemy combatants, two, individuals who might have been trying to utilize things like, you know, these created explosive devices and all that kind of stuff. All of this is mixed together into this system. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And the that's why, you know, Miller and Fast, General Fast, General Miller, both said we need more contractors over here to do these interrogations. So to justify their own positions, these contractors would, because most of them were local hires and they had the Arabic language skill, and they and imagine how that works. Okay, because these are local people. They're speaking Arabic to people that are being interrogated or being questioned before you can even apply the word interrogation. And they could be passing information outside because these interrogators, the contractors, they're leaving the camp every night. They're going home, you know. I wouldn't say they were working 9 to 5, but they're going home at the end of the day. And leaving, who knows what they were doing with the information that they were gleaning from these questioning sessions, or if there was any consistency, or even if they were trained to do that kind of work, which is highly unlikely.
See, that's another consideration. You have no security based on the fact that these people are being intermingled, number one. Number two, if you have local contractors who are pretty much they have the advantage here because they know the language, they know the landscape, et cetera, that's fine. But there's no way of assuring that if there was legitimate intelligence being collected through the first questioning and then interrogation, you have no way of securing that information or protecting it or not having it contaminated by the contractors who are coming and going on a daily. This to me sounds like almost chaos that you were being asked to control.
Try managing chaos. That's exactly right. And remember, in there was actually 17 prison facilities to include the high value detainees that we were responsible for their management. Very close to the Baghdad airport. And that included the people that were, you know, considered that they were the Decca cards under Saddam. And it would ultimately be where Saddam was captured and brought to. So do you see how bizarre this is? The detention process has now evolved, and the one facility where General Sanchez, General Miller, and General Fast have decided that's where Colonel Pappas and the military intelligence interrogators need to be assigned. They come out there, there's literally a flood of civilian Iraqi contractors that have been hired by CACI and the other, whatever the name of the other contracting agency was, to do interrogations. A flood of interrogators show up. Why? Because they're going to meet the demand of all these sweeps that are being undertaken by the divisions. And they, each one of the divisions in each of their areas, Odierno, Petraeus, all of these guys, their units had intelligence units assigned. That's the normal configuration of a division. Okay.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going up against the first hour break here. Janice Karpinski is my guest tonight. I call her General Janice Karpinski, although technically that may not be exactly accurate. I don't care. That's the title she earned, so that's exactly what I'm going to call her. Anyway, she is my special guest tonight, and we are just getting to the point where, believe it or not, we're going to break down Abu Ghraib from somebody who understands it a whole lot more than I do. And we've already heard some things here tonight that I guarantee are shocking to you guys out there. So stay tuned to American Freedom Radio, The Ocelli Effect. We'll be right back, like I said, with General Janice Karpinski. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of microplant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
Everybody talking about gun control. Gotta get rid of the guns. I like guns. You got a gun, you don't have to work out. I ain't working out. I ain't jogging. You don't need no gun control. You know what you need? We need some bullet control. We need to control the bullets. That's right. I think all bullets should cost $5,000. You know why? Because if a bullet costs $5,000, there'll be no more innocent bystanders. Every time somebody gets shot, you'll be like, damn, he must have did something. So they put $50,000 worth of bullets in his ass. And people will think before they kill somebody if a bullet costs $5,000. Man, I would blow your head off if I could afford it. I'm gonna get me another job. I'm gonna start saving some money. And you a dead man.
Now, to balance the scale, I'd like to talk about some things that bring us together. Things that point out our similarities instead of our differences. Because that's all you ever hear about in this country is our differences. That's all the media and the politicians are ever talking about, the things that separate us. Things that make us different from one another. That's the way the ruling class operates in any society. They try to divide the rest of the people. They keep the lower and the middle classes fighting with each other so that they, the rich, can run off with all the money. Fairly simple thing happens to work. You know, anything different, that's what they're going to talk about. Race, religion, ethnic and national background, jobs, income, education, social status, sexuality, anything you can do, keep us fighting with each other so that they can keep going to the bank. You know how I describe the economic and social classes in this country? The upper class keeps all of the money, pays none of the taxes. The middle class pays all of the taxes, does all of the work. The poor are there just to scare the middle class.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFI wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules.
No rules.
No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.
My big pharma got the populace wonderfully dumb. Addicted to deadly drugs to keep them under their thumb. You're dealing with scum. Handsomely paid to peddle poison. Enjoy something that grows out of the ground. That annoys them. Destroy them. Let them know you're privy to their thin scam. Stand tall. Don't ever fall for the flim-flam. Most politicians are supporters of NAMBLA and actors who follow a script similar to Tony Danza. Who's the boss? It'll cost if you're a gambler. I disappear you off of the grid like Adam Lanza. My mantra, incarcerate inquisitors and put them on serotonin reuptake inhibitors.
So the second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins, and of course our special guest tonight is General Janice Karpinski. We have discussed so far what the landscape was like during the, well, first of all, we gave a good description of the history of her military career, but also coming into the invasion / occupation of Iraq. What happened to this prison system? What happened? Camp Buka, we've heard about it. Abu Ghraib, obviously, we were treated to the 60 Minutes expose. We were treated to the discussions ever after. We've been treated to the idea that there were many abuses, many things that happened that should not have. My guest tonight was, in my estimation, summarily and unfairly punished for these things by being demoted. And also, I don't really appreciate some of the narratives that have been put out about her. I think she absolutely earned, number one, her rank. She earned the respect that she had of many of the people, because I've talked to people who have interacted with you, Janice. I've talked to people that witnessed your behaviors personally. You're an extremely honorable, conscientious human being.
And thank you for that.
It's just absolutely reprehensible to me that that you were made the scapegoat for this. When we take a look at the situation you laid out in the first hour, okay, when we understand that, you know, you were given an impossible task, really, to control that situation, a lot of things could have happened. And I'd like to kind of rejoin the conversation with Abu Ghraib because, you know, that is the bullet point. That's the big headline here because that's the name people know. That's what people got to see.
Right.
You know, the images of the bags over the head, the stress positions, all of these discussions, and even the fact that probably nobody was really paying all that much attention to oversight committees so much until enhanced interrogation needed to be discussed, until methodologies of interrogation needed to be discussed, but, you know, of detainees, right, which I still find to be a really antiseptic term used for prisoners.
Right.
You know, all of this, I mean, I kind of throw it to you, and I know it's a bit of a rough explanation. You've been over this many times, but I'd appreciate it.
Because I think it's important to understand.
Yes, absolutely. And I want you to help us understand it better. So go ahead.
Well, I again, we'll start from Abu Ghraib because Abu Ghraib at the time, and it was a big shift, at the time that it was only a large, the largest prison operation, Iraqi prison operation, it was becoming increasingly dangerous, and we did not have the units that were running Abu Ghraib, two military police battalions at that time. They did not have any of the combat platforms to defend, to protect the prisoners. They weren't prisoners of war, but to protect the prisoners or themselves. So we were, and we knew that one of the battalions was nearing a year in Iraq, so we knew that we were going to lose a battalion. So we were trying desperately to release the prisoners who had been cleared by the military intelligence and the the JAG officers' reviews. We had a review board, and they were all nominated for release. We put these release lists together. So we got the population that was several thousand through June, July, and August. We got it down to under 700. And we knew a couple more release boards, if we'd be able to transfer this line of prisoners to the downtown one. We'd transfer a line of prisoners up to Mosul, where, you know, they were from that area. So that was our plan, and it was moving along. Rough conditions, absolutely. The confinement areas were outside in the heat of June, July, and August. We had very little running water. We had a contractor who, unfortunately, was assassinated in his own driveway, but he did a tremendous amount of work in support of the prisoners and in support of me and the military police units that were doing the jailer work. Then General Miller, Secretary Rumsfeld, Barbara Fast, General Sanchez, and the division commanders cooked this plan that they're going to do these sweeps to bring in people that have information about the location of Saddam Hussein, if there's nuclear weapons in Iraq, where they're stored. So they exploit some information that they obtained. They give these target lists, as they were called, to each one of the divisions. The divisions put together these operations to go out to these grid coordinates and find these individuals. Okay, that's a basic military concept. However, some of the people that were on these lists at that particular grid coordinate, it was from 15 years earlier, 10 years earlier. It wasn't current information. So what do? They go to these grid coordinates, they find the building, they undertake an operation, and like you said, they're looking for a guy that's about between 25 and 28 years old, dark hair, and has a beard. And that's just about every man that's sitting in the building at that grid coordinate. What do? They haul them all in. If one person there has information, then all of those 52 people have information. They haul them in. And suddenly, because helicopters start to arrive at Abu Ghraib, dropping off these prisoners with two specific things that are very disturbing. Canvas bags over their heads, handcuffed, zip-tied behind their back, and a tag, a prisoner of war tag that simply says detainee. So I said, the battalion commander out there calls me in the dead of the night and says, ma'am, I don't know what's going on. I don't know anything about it. I go to General Sanchez. He says, there'll be a briefing in a couple of days, like this is going to go away. And, they never read me, the commander of the military police, they never read me into this operation. So the deputy commander, General Wojciechowski, heard me asking General Sanchez for information. So General Wojciechowski said, look, this is what we're doing, and this is why this is so important. I said, when were you going to tell me, sir? My battalion commanders are out there receiving all these prisoners. They had no idea that they were coming. Well, because that's the essence of secrecy. Several months before, I knew all about the essence of secrecy, what they were doing to specific individuals for trying to get the right information through the intelligence channels about nuclear storage and warheads and everything else. But in this particular case, we went from August with less than 700 Iraqi criminal prisoners, minor crimes, being held at Abu Ghraib and pending almost immediate release. The end of September, we had over 3,500 detainees. And a month later, there was over 7,000 detainees. I said to Colonel Warren, was the senior JAG officer for General Sanchez. I said to Colonel Warren, what does that mean? They have tags on and it says detainees. And what did he say to me? Ma'am, that means they have no rights at all.
Wow. Now, look, here's where I enter another question. Now, a prisoner of war,
has rights under international law, under the Geneva Convention.
Absolutely.
A prisoner in a locality who is being imprisoned for a crime, depending on the legal structure in a particular nation, has rights. We may not agree with them. They may be odd. They may even seem strange. It could be that they need to see a three-judge panel. It could be that they are guilty until proven innocent. It could be et cetera, et cetera. But either way, there are some rights that are applied to anybody that is a prisoner. Okay?
Absolutely.
I use that word stressfully again. But is this creating a new category? A detainee now has no rights? Is that about what you're saying?
Absolutely. Because they were suspected of being involved or being an associate of somebody who was involved in crimes directed against the United States. What does that mean? That they were... because of this list that they were making, the list for the divisions from where they obtained this list from an operation that they undertook, they believed that all of this information that they exploited from that operation was going to lead them to Saddam. And all of these individuals who were on that list were only there because they had some connection to those lists and to Saddam Hussein. It's insane. It's even insane saying it now.
It sounds crazy. Go ahead though. I have to enter my disbelief here that this is a military operation that this seems to be effective, efficient, or even productive, really, because here's the back end of it, and I know you're going to address this as you go further, and I want you to make your points here, but how much dissent in the local population, you know, does anybody even take that into account? I mean, was that ever brought up as you're saying, hey, what's going on here?
Yes.
Why is it I have a 10-to-1? I mean, does anybody say, hey, look, you know what? We're going to aggravate the local population. We've just taken down their government, whatever you think of them. We've just destabilized their nation, which means that we've destabilized any of the cities, villages, towns, whatever they are. We have now caused all this chaos. And on top of it, we are sweeping up and picking up individuals at an alarming rate. Isn't that going to anger the population? But go ahead, continue.
You're sweeping up sons, brothers, husbands, fathers, uncles, all of the male population throughout Iraq without reason, without justification. And I will tell you this, because this is another important point. Even though at the time, minus an effective court system, we were applying the laws that would apply in the United States. And that's the point that we were getting to with our release program. Look, you know, Yerrick, you think it's a privilege to think about being the judge and the jury? I effectively became the judge and the jury based on recommendations from the legal people, the military intelligence, and the actual record of whatever crime they committed. They'd give them to me with a recommendation, and I'd say yes, 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 and we put these release lists together. But, you know, in the United States, without reason, you can't hold somebody for ad nauseum. You can hold them for 72 hours. And if they ask for a lawyer, you better provide one. So when I went to Ambassador Bremer and I said, hey, some of these guys are asking for lawyers, for attorneys. He said, well, we don't have that many attorneys to go around. You know, just look at what the records are and make recommendations as you've been doing. Okay, that's how we proceeded. But the Iraqi law was more fair, despite what people might think about under Saddam. Now, his private circle, you know, did he execute people? Yes. Did he have them executed summarily? Yes. But, and were the prison systems brutal? Absolutely. But the Iraqi law and the judges under the Iraqi law were more fair than our court system in the United States. So here we have an effective release program working. We're making the local population fairly happy that they know that their loved one was out after curfew, but we'll be home soon. So, I mean, we had no means of communication. It was a regular process for mothers and daughters and wives to be in their traditional garb, sitting on the ground outside the gates of Abu Ghraib, thinking maybe their loved one would be released that day, which, you know, it's not comical, but just picture that in your mind. So now, suddenly, within, I mean, a moment's notice, not even notifying me until that it was happening, now we go from less than 1,000 to over 3,000 to over 7,000, and the contractors who are doing the interrogations, the military intelligence who are doing the interrogations, no, look, there was a major who did work in Afghanistan, and he put a blitz of a email message out to the intelligence units throughout Iraq and said, the gloves come off, do whatever you need to do to get the information.
Wow.
This is an American major in the United States Army saying such a thing as we are deployed to a international location. So imagine what every Iraqi citizen thought about every one of us Americans.
Mm. And this is the real, the buildup to what actually happened then, right? I mean, if you're being told now, as somebody who's there, and once again, under the condition of not being properly supported, maybe having to have worried about your pay, you know, all of this kind of interesting compartmentalization where the commander of the police has no idea what's happening to the prison system, which has now been given to you to run, despite the fact that your original mission seemed to be to just handle prisoners of war, which is a completely different operation, unless
completely.
I am misunderstanding.
No, that's completely true. And now mm-hmm. we have General Miller and General Fast and General, after Secretary Rumsfeld's visit, and General Sanchez. Now they have signed Colonel Pappas and the military intelligence units out to Abu Ghraib to run the interrogation operation, not the camps. The interrogation operation.
Mm.
Because from the camps, the interrogations, the interviews at first, they're producing about one in every 300 needs further questioning. And the ones that they hauled in to cell block 1A were oftentimes found, identified, and arrested and brought in by the special operations people. Not by these sweeps. The sweeps produced nothing, even though they felt obligated to identify about one in every 300 or 400 for further interview. You know, and then who knows if the contractors were making up the information that they were documenting or not. Who knows? Nobody knows. Because nobody was controlling them. They came and went as they pleased. They selected a prisoner, dragged them into an interrogation cell, and who knows what took place there. Why? Because there were no pictures. The pictures that were released and broadcast across 60 Minutes or whoever the channel was that released them first, they were intentionally set up to be used in future interrogations if they were interviewing somebody who had decided to shut up. Oh, you want to talk? How about this? Open the laptop, and there's a picture of the prisoners in the pyramid setting, or with a dog leash on them, naked, beaten up, bag over the head, seeming like they were connected to electrical wires. Those pictures were staged. Nobody should believe that any one of those soldiers came to Iraq to do a prisoner of war mission and came fully equipped with canvas bags, dog collars, dog leashes, electrical lines. No, those items, those props, were all brought to them by General Miller's team when they came from Guantanamo Bay.
Wow.
He didn't share any of that with me. He didn't tell me what he was going to do. All he did was have a briefing, asked everybody to leave, and then he told me, look, I want to take over Abu Ghraib. And I said, sir, Abu Ghraib belongs to Iraq. It is not my prison to give to you. If Ambassador Bremer says to give it to you, you can have it. Because I'm going to, he said, because I'm going to make it the interrogation center for all of Iraq.
Mm.
Yeah. Not, I said, we're in the process of closing it down. No. Close nothing down. He didn't say why. He didn't say how. He didn't say anything except he was going to make it the interrogation center for all of Iraq.
Wow.
And he did.
And it's extremely frightening to me that the idea, see, the concept that went out to the public is that, that these photographs, that these images, the videos, and there's apparently a lot more that have not been seen in public, from my understanding. But the idea that this was being staged so that it could be utilized as, well, as a methodology later to apply to other prisoners, I use that word again, because detainee is a ridiculous term, but other prisoners that they would have in the future, listen, you don't want to talk, you don't want to give us information, well, here's the kind of things that we might do to you. Meanwhile, these are minor. These are somewhat minor violations, but they are all minor. They are all violations of what should have been standard practice, unless I misunderstand again, based on the way that people are trained to do these things.
Hmm? There was no evidence. There wasn't a list saying John Smith, Joe Smith, Frank Smith. There was no list of names. It was a list of geographical coordinates. They sent these units out. Whoever you find there, you police up. And if there's a building there, bring everybody back that has a beard and looks like they're 28 years old. And they all of a sudden became detainee. Detainee 1, detainee 7,640, detainee 9,500. There was over 10,000 detainees by the end of that year. September, October, November, December. Over 10,000 detainees. And nobody, General Sanchez, Colonel Warren, the JAG officer, none of those commanders, not even Pappas himself, could stand and tell me what is a detainee. Colonel Warren said, that means they don't have any rights, ma'am. He didn't say what a detainee is.
Mm.
It's an Iraqi that we're holding against his will. And we're going to hold them indefinitely. Is that not offensive to every freedom-loving American?
Well, it certainly should be. It certainly should be, especially with no, once again, with no real process here that proves that there is a reason to hold them, specifically that person. Remember, specifically that person, simply because you know a crime was committed and you may have a general idea of a description, it does not mean, let's just imagine here in America, okay, that you have a general description of someone and you know that they generally live in a particular neighborhood and here's their age, their race, whatever, general description. If you were to go to that neighborhood and sweep up, let's just say that it's a white male, 30 years of age. If you were to go to that neighborhood in America and literally detain, okay, every white male 30 years of age or any white male who appears as though they could be within that age range in a, say, 2-mile radius or something like that in an American neighborhood, people would lose their minds because it's absolutely reprehensible to behave like that based on we could go back to the Magna Carta. This is not to be done.
Okay? And we're not talking about ignorant people. The Iraqis were educated. They were uneducated. There were lawyers, doctors, professors, teachers, mothers, fathers, cooks, across every socioeconomic. There didn't seem to be any discrimination. They hauled everybody in, just like you're saying. They're in this grid location, and they look like an Iraqi. Oh, gee, haul them in. And they did. So you have intelligent people. You have people that are hard workers. You have people that maybe are uneducated. They're all held there together, and they're looking to each other. Can't you talk to the military police? Can't you talk to those civilians? Tell them we want a lawyer. Tell them we want to know why we're here. Tell them nothing. No answers, no response, no lawyers, no anything. For day after day, for week after week. Now, let's just jump forward just very quickly. Imagine yourself in that situation. I hope every one of your listeners, just close your eyes for a second. Imagine yourself in that situation. And then all of a sudden, 6 months later, you're released. Mm. Now, you might be overwhelmed with joy initially, but very quickly, your anger comes to the surface. And you don't care what it takes, and you don't know how long it's going to take, but you are going to get even.
Well, and you can't, you can't blame somebody for being angry over that. You can't. See, that's the thing. There's legitimate reasons why the Iraqi population, this is just one of them, by the way. This is one of the reasons why the Iraqi population was not thrilled with us and is not thrilled with us to this day, as far as I'm concerned. And I think they're completely justified. I really do. I mean, between this, you know, the depleted uranium, the fact that a lot of lawlessness was produced in that country based on the actions that they saw being taken by people in uniforms that represented the United States, that represented the, quote, coalition, end quote, whatever. Okay. All of that creates a legitimate, well, what do we call that exactly? Backlash, I mean, is the only word that comes to mind immediately, but blowback, I don't know. There's lots of different terms we could use here, but that's a legitimate thing that happened, yes?
That's right. That's right. You and, you know, amongst the ranks, you see whether people were silenced or not, but you see military people that are being treated unfairly and being silenced, and we had a clue. Because if you remember before when Guantanamo Bay was set up, I don't know if you remember this or not, but there was a captain who was a chaplain. He was a West Point graduate. He was a chaplain down at Gitmo. And he was on regular leave, and he was coming back to the United States. And he had been a dissenter down there of sorts. He confronted General Miller. He confronted a couple of the full colonels that were in the operations down there, that what they were doing to prisoners was wrong, that they had to be given their rights. They had to, because at Guantanamo Bay, they were, it was like a prisoner of war camp for all practical purposes. But that's not what it ultimately became, obviously, but that's what they were using it as, to get prisoners down there under the radar of the press and the Red Cross and everybody else. But he was confronting them with violations of rights, and that these were good and decent people, and if they had information, you weren't going about obtaining it the right way. And that was when we found out that waterboarding and everything else was taking place down at Guantanamo Bay and in Afghanistan long before we ever heard about it anywhere else. But nonetheless, he right. was on regular leave. And the only way you could leave Guantanamo Bay and get back to the United States was a military hop. So they would load them up and bring them to Jacksonville, Florida, and then they would go on regular commercial flights from there. He came back. They met him at the airport, they being security people, put a bag over his head, headphones on him, played loud music, and dragged him to the Charleston, South Carolina Navy brig, where he was held for 38 days. He was a captain in the United States Army, and this was, by General Miller's orders, done against him by other Americans.
Mm. Wow.
So when you heard any of, or when we heard or didn't hear the stories of what was happening to our own service people by other Americans in Iraq, it was completely believable. And what was happening at Abu Ghraib became sensationalized. But as I said, the expression I used from the beginning was, those photographs gave everybody, gave the world a peek behind the curtain. And in an effort to get ahead of that, the sitting administration, Rumsfeld, Cheney, et al., they had to come up with something real quick. So they immediately started to talk about those soldiers in the pictures. Like I said, the sitting president of the United States condemns them as seven bad apples. The president of the United States calls you a bad apple. What chance do you have? And then they need to put the spotlight on somebody that's going to sicken the American people. And there's nothing more sickening than a female general officer who has allowed this to happen. Shame on you, Karpinski.
Mm. And this is where this really turns. And we've already described how unmanageable the situation had become, really. Okay.
Right.
But even worse to me is what happens next, because there were some young people that were involved in those photographs. There were some people whose lives have been absolutely destroyed as a result of really going along to get along here with the program that was in front of them, or at least that's the way they saw it. And how did they have another way to see it? I don't know. But meanwhile, you just seem to be the sacrificial lamb for this as a commander. And I don't even know how to describe this. I mean, what was that like?
It was horrible because I'm saying to everyone, look, I was not in charge of interrogation. I ran 17 prison facilities in Iraq. The military intelligence and that whole battery of contractors that General Miller sent to Iraq, they were running the interrogation. Those soldiers, they would never have, if you remember the original reports, these kids had nothing better to do with their time on the night shift than to come up with ideas on how they could torture prisoners. Really? Mm. Really? What kind of insanity is this? And why were the American people so willing to believe it? No, I mean, it was offensive to me. Yes, absolutely. And I'll tell you something. I'll tell all of your listeners this a billion times over. They knew that Janis Karpinski, if I became aware of it, I would have stopped it. And that's why it was so important to keep me from knowing. They sent me here. They sent me there. Create a postal system for all of Iraq. You have signal people that you're, and their civilian jobs. They work for Verizon. I want you to set up a telephone system for all of Iraq. Anything to keep me from being at Abu Ghraib to see what was going on. And then, you want to talk about shock and awe? When I'm confronted with it and blamed for it? No.
Well, that's something else that's been universally reported to me by anyone who is involved in the situation. When your name comes up, the first thing that anybody who knows anything about this says is that I guarantee if this had been reported to General Karpinski, if this had been known to General Karpinski, if she had not been intentionally kept out of the loop in a lot of different ways. Some people say that it was because your subordinates just simply did not supply you with the information at all. Okay. But also I think it seems as though there was a concerted effort to keep you busy, as you just described, with other things, which, you know, not like you weren't busy enough running, you know, 17 facilities and having to deal with this other chaos we've already described. Not as though you you had loads and loads of free time to deal with here, but the idea is that, intentionally it seems as though you were completely kept out of the loop because you would have put a stop to this, obviously.
Absolutely. And my soldiers knew it, and I know it. I know it. I spent 8 years in the Middle East after Desert Storm. I set up a women's military training program for the women in the United Arab Emirates. There was nothing closer to my heart than seeing those women make a difference in their country and in themselves. And they did a phenomenal job. But the time I spent there, I traveled throughout the Middle East at that time because we went to see other programs, et cetera. But I came to understand the Muslim religion, the Muslim people, the people in these different countries, poor, rich, wealthy, not wealthy, educated, uneducated. I came to understand them. When I was deployed to Iraq, I believed I would be able to make a difference in a positive way in that country for those people. I set out when I was in Baghdad, if I was getting ready for a meeting down in Bremer's office or in Sanchez's office, I would make a point of meeting with some Iraqi people, Iraqi men and women, down there at that massive headquarters of Bremer's. And I'd ask them, what do people think about prisoner operations before? What did they think about people that worked in those facilities? Because we're going to set up a training program for a different way of handling prison operations. What kind of, you know, what kind of pipe dream was that, you wonder? They sent these contractors, like I said, they sent four. One of them left, so that left three, obviously. Very lucrative contracts, did not know anything about setting up a training program, and ultimately did not. They took the big money, and the military police not only wrote the program for it, but they did the instruction. And that was the direction that my unit, my soldiers were taking. When we're here, we can do some good. So let's set out to do it. And had nothing to do with what took place out at Abu Ghraib, because that was all on Colonel Pappas' shoulder, his interrogators, those contractors that Miller had hired locally to go in there and do whatever they needed to do. And they were the ones who went to Grainer and those soldiers on the night shift and said, look, we'd like some photographs. And this is what we're going to use them for. You know, it'll make them make these interrogations go a little bit faster. And you know, you got to kind of keep this to yourselves, but this is what we'd like you to do. And they gave them the direction. Where do you think they got those that inspiration? From right down there at Gitmo, at Guantanamo Bay, under Miller's watch, because that's what they were doing down there. And they needed some photographs.
Right. And as you said, it would be utilized in later interrogations in order to, you know, at the very least use them as threats, but also seemingly to instruct future interrogators. I think that it seems as though nobody thought that the whole world would get to see this stuff, or if they did think that the world would get to see it, it would be perfectly all right because it was acceptable to handle honestly. I mean, let's just be blunt here for a moment. Because of the war on terror, the American sentiment had shifted to once again dehumanizing the enemy. This has been a common practice, you know, throughout our history. When we are engaged in battle with an enemy who has particular ethnic identifiable traits, let's call them. I mean, look, we can look back at World War II. We can talk about the fact that the Japanese were virtually described as inhuman. We could go back to the idea that the Germans were, what, Huns. We could go back to the Vietnamese. What were they? Well, you know, here's a little offensive language, but they were just gooks. They were not really human beings worthy of anything other than being the targets of whatever it is we were to unleash. So this is a common practice. This is a common way of making it more acceptable in some cases. Here's the justification I've read about it, is that it makes it easier for troops to be able to kill other human beings if they dehumanize them in the troops' minds, things like this. So we know that this is something that happens. But in addition, I think that
Go ahead.
Okay. I want you to speak to that, though. Go ahead.
Well, I think that it became it went beyond a dehumanization. It was racism, because the enemy became everybody. Every single person that looked like an Iraqi was suddenly the enemy. I mean, this is after the declaration of mission accomplished. This is when we're supposed to be involved in nation building. Okay? It's the hunt for Saddam. The Iraqis didn't know where Saddam was. Maybe a small circle of his closest associates, and half of them at least, were being held at the high-value detainee facility. So he was basically, and you know, the reports were, leading up to his capture, the reports were that Saddam looked like a bum, like a farmer that hadn't been, you know, hadn't bathed in a couple of months, and he had an orange Datsun pickup truck. And he would occasionally come through Baghdad. Sometimes he'd have a couple of goats in his truck or whatever, and he'd pass these points, and he'd act like he couldn't speak English. I mean, this is what the Iraqis were saying. They would be making jokes about it. And do you know, they said specifically it was an orange Datsun pickup truck, one of the small ones, and that was the one that he was usually driving, and it seemed to be working. Nobody ever identified him. Was always on the run. But do you know, when they found him in that hole up there in the 4th Division area, Odierno's area, you know what was parked right outside the hole where he was found? The orange Johnson pickup truck. So, I mean, it becomes almost the time in between the invasion, the declaration of mission accomplishment, the real hunt all along was to find Saddam. Weapons of mass destruction, when they were identified, we all know what happened in that situation. Okay, you silence that person too. You know, you shoot the messenger, literally, but, you know, didn't kill him. So, but everybody, soldiers were so frustrated. Reserve, National Guard, Marines, I don't care what service it was or in what capacity, they all wanted to get out.
Right.
Because it was just continuing, and it was going down the wrong every day. Units would go out and hope to be alive to come back. No mission, go out on patrols, you find people, haul them in. And I think the majority of soldiers knew what they were doing was wrong. They have no rights. We're bringing them in to do what? They send them out to Abu Ghraib and they're going to be there for a month? No wonder people are hiding in their houses and digging holes and trying to conceal themselves. But at one point, the deputy commander to Sanchez, I said to him, look, sir, we have to release some of these people. That we're holding them with no evidence and no justification. And he turned around, square in my face, said to me, General, I don't care if we arrest every single Iraqi. We're winning the war. And I said, no, sir, you are not. Because ultimately, every one of them is going to be angry with us the day they're released.
Well, see, now this is the thing, is that when people were looking back and seeing, you know, there are improvised explosive devices being detonated and our troops are being targeted and they're being shot at by the civilians and, oh, these people just hate us, you know, so on and so forth. The reality is that this is why. This is part of why.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's again, like you asked everybody to consider for a moment, close their eyes for a moment and think about this. Well, think about this one. Imagine that we're not talking about Iraq. Imagine we're talking about the eastern seaboard of the United States. This was happening. I got to tell you, if this was happening all along the eastern seaboard here, I'd be out there with explosive devices. I'd be more than happy to shoot at these people because this is what they're doing. I can't even see how you wouldn't logically
be in a enraged. I mean, what else are you supposed to do?
How would you like to wake up tomorrow morning and look out your kitchen window and normally see the birds outside at the feeder, and all of a sudden there's people there with guns and funny uniforms holding the shooting at your neighbors and having you in the sights? How would you feel? Yeah, you're right. You'd be setting IEDs. You'd be shooting back if you had the means.
Exactly.
And you'd be angry. And then they're gonna come and they're gonna put a set of handcuffs on you and they're gonna haul you away. Yeah, you'd be angry.
Mm.
You know, I mean, in desperation, Iraqis were saying to soldiers as the units were coming through, if I knew where he was, I would take you to him. I don't know. If our president was on the run because of received threats, and we get invaded and they're coming to you saying, where is he? You would have as good a chance as any of these Iraqi citizens did. None at all.
Right. Right. And that's the story there. Now, you know, as we go through this, and look, we've definitely hit this point very, very hard, and we've only got about another 10 minutes to be able to talk to you tonight. I definitely want to make sure that I have you back on, because we've only really provided people with a snapshot of this story, in my estimation, but I want to elaborate on this and some other issues quite a bit more in the future with you. The thing is that just for the listeners' edification, you know, if you want to read Janice Karpinski's account, the book is called One Woman's Army, okay, and it's available on Amazon and various other places. I would suggest you take a look at it. I believe it's the only book you authored.
Correct.
Which is obviously a memoir of what we talked about tonight, in addition to some other things that are relevant to the story. I kind of want to close it out with a discussion about how it was going through the process of really having to absorb the blame for that, which I don't see how anybody could have controlled this. I really don't.
Well, here, this will be the last couple of minutes of your show. Let me tell you the process. What process?
Sure.
I never was relieved of command. I never saw anybody face to face. Nobody ever called me in, locked my heels, and told me I was no longer a general officer. Nothing. I never had a face-to-face conversation. They were all cowards. Not one of them, not one of them wanted to see me face-to-face and tell me what they were accusing me of, because they knew it was an out-and-out lie. Anything they could have thrown at me about being a bad leader or being unsuccessful, they could not do it. Because they all knew the truth. And the truth was that I was the target, I was the scapegoat, and they were directed to make it happen. I never saw it. You know, everybody thinks that I was subjected to Rumsfeld or, you know, a senior leader somewhere. My boss was General Helmley. Never saw him. Never saw that coward. He never came. One time he came to Iraq, spent 2 hours with a unit, and got on a plane and left. Did not come to another unit, did not see me, did not call me into his office to relieve me. It was all a paperwork drill.
Mm.
Cold, callous, calculated, tough. You don't like it? Tough. No, you don't get a voice. No. And they stacked the deck before I even got here. So the day that I got back to the States from Iraq, 60 Minutes released the photograph.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I did not know that, actually, that's how that happened. Okay.
And as a matter of fact, my boss in Iraq, or the boss that I would eventually have that was holding me until they gave clearance from Rumsfeld's office for me to go back to the States, he said to me, Janice, there's nothing here. You're going to be okay. You did the right thing. Hold your head up high. Go back to the States. you're going to have a great career. That's what he said to me. And he was an active duty 3-star. That's what he said to me. And I guess Rumsfeld and company didn't appreciate it because ultimately he was, 5 years later, he was retired because he got into a contest with, I don't even want to go into all the details. But, yeah, that's how they get even with people that don't follow the rules. Mm. That's how they get even with them. If anybody, while I was there, if anybody had said these are the rules and you're breaking them, I would have listened very carefully. There were no rules. Everybody was breaking them.
Yeah, so there was never a chance for you to even answer the charges. I mean, there wasn't a formal hearing. There wasn't, Article 38, whatever it is, you know, where they have a disciplinary hearing because none of that happened, is what you're telling
me. None of it happened. They, Taguba, Anthony Taguba, who was a 2-star, who very much wanted to be a 3-star, so he was kissing up to anybody he could find to kiss up to, including Sanchez, and mm-hmm. he did an investigation. It was full of holes. It was full of compromises. He had a JAG officer that was telling him exactly what he should say, not under oath. He was telling Taguba, this is what you should say, because Taguba was completely out of his element. He didn't know. He spent his deployment time down in Kuwait. They made him come up to Iraq. He was scared out of his life because he had to work, do interviews in the combat zone. He conducted this big investigation. It ultimately became the Taguba report, and it was full of holes, full of holes. He had a guy that sat on, he had like 14 people on his board, sitting in on the interviews. And, he had a guy that was a medical doctor in the reserve components, in the medical reserves. And he was, working with the interrogators out at Abu Ghraib. Now imagine that. This guy was a psychiatrist or a psychologist by medical training. And he was working with the interrogators out at Abu Ghraib to determine what would make them talk, what would be the particular pressure on this individual, what would be the best means to get this individual to talk. That's all a violation of the Geneva Convention, but they were not prisoners of war, so that made it okay. They were detainees.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, in the closing minutes here, I always ask this of any guest of importance on this show for sure. What is it that, because we obviously only really scratched the surface of your story in total, but what is it that that you would really like someone to take away from this discussion? If they've never heard your name before, if they never understood what happened before, I mean, what is it that that you would like people to take away from this discussion tonight?
I'd like them to take away this. Do not be misled. Do not be deceived by what the government and its agencies of publication, whatever they were putting out. Question everything, because from the beginning, this war has been a fabrication of the truth. And you want to get to what really was going on, then question yourself, ask yourself, and question every piece of information. Question everything I'm saying. Look it up. Look it up and form your own opinions, but do not be misled, because we were all taken in, and the government took advantage of us in our response and reeling in response to 9/11. And at our weakest moment, they said, we know who did this, and we need to go get them. And we all bought into it because we were afraid. And they kept reminding us that we needed to be afraid. Be very afraid.
Yeah,
that was the justification to march forward with this ridiculous plan.
That's the absolute truth, is that by fear, they definitely manipulated the population in general. They utilized every facility they could, and they prosecuted an illegal and immoral war on so many levels. Based on that, it's amazing. General Janis Karpinski was my guest tonight. The Ocelli Effect is done, but
General Karpinski, I want to say thank you for spending this time with us, and I really do hope we can do some more in the future because, like I said, we only just scratched the surface.
Absolutely, and thank you so much. It was a privilege to spend this time with you, and I do appreciate your continued support and interest.
Absolutely. And, guys, we'll be back tomorrow night, but Janice Karpinski will return to this show if I have anything to say about it, I assure you. And if you missed it, you need to go back in the archives. Stay tuned to American Freedom Radio. The Ocelli Effect is done, but what comes next will also be of interest because it is AFR. See you tomorrow.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
Yo, what's up? Check this out.
The voice of the revolution. American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
What about show business? Show business, completely dishonest, corrupt, and full of shit, but in a nice way. Plenty of expensive drugs and perverted sex. If you're going to be full of shit, might as well enjoy your work. Then you have the media. Not just the news media, let's include them all. The media are almost literally exploding with bullshit because they're located right at the crossroads of all the other bullshit. The media are made up of equal parts advertising, politics, business, public relations, and show business. These people are sitting right at bullshit junction. There's enough bullshit in the media for Texas to open a branch office. And you still have enough left over to start two law firms and a Christian bookstore. On election day, I stay home. I don't vote. I don't vote. Two reasons. Two reasons I don't vote. First of all, it's meaningless. This country was bought and sold and paid for a long time ago. The they shuffle around every 4 years. Doesn't mean anything. And secondly, I don't vote because I believe if you vote, you have no right to complain. People like to twist that around, I know. They say, well, if you don't vote, you have no right to complain. But where's the logic in that? If you vote and you elect dishonest, incompetent people, and they get into office and screw everything up, well, you are responsible for what they have done. You caused the problem. You voted them in. You have no right to complain. I, on the other hand, who did not vote, in fact, did not even leave the house on election day, am in no way responsible for what these people have done and have every right to complain as loud as I want about the mess you created that I had nothing to do with.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest, and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom, and loyalty. The founders of AFI wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules.
No rules.
No taboo topics.
No taboo topics.
No fear of doom.
No fear of doom.
We are
American Freedom Radio.
American Freedom Radio.